Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Markets Podcast. I'm Paul Sweeney, alongside my co-host, Matt Miller.
Every business day, we bring you interviews from CEOs, market pros, and Bloomberg experts, along with essential market-moving news.
Find the Bloomberg Markets Podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts and at Bloomberg.com/podcast. Let's go right to our next guest, Hans Dow, CEO of the Mitchell Madison Group. I want to talk to him because we had some much weaker than expected economic data come out of China overnight, and that's kind of spooking markets a little bit. So we said, let's talk to somebody who kind of doves this stuff. But here, so he's the CEO of Mitchell Madison Group, but here's the scam. Jackson, Wyoming since 1994. You were doing the remote thing, Hans, before it was the cool thing to do. How are you working this scam to be working from Jackson, Wyoming? That's the first question.
Oh, you know, the truth is even worse. I split my time between Jackson Hole and Malibu. I just got back.
Oh, you're killing us.
So it is even worse.
All right. Well, the good stuff is, Matt, he has got his undergraduate from the University of Michigan. You'll be happy about that.
Oh, he's a Wolverine.
But even more impressive for me, MBA from the Tuck School. The Tuck School is such an awesome school at Dartmouth.
Out of Dartmouth,
For the MBA program. And all the Tucks that I know are really smart, and they're super duper loyal to their school for some unknown reason. Hans, what's going on in China here? This data, I mean, it just seems they've got some challenges over there. What do you make of it?
Well, I think what's going on in China is just the result of COVID lockdowns. That insane zero COVID policy has taken effect. Obviously, we've all seen that. But it's also a significant wealth effect from the property crash, right? I mean, if the population has been, it's highly leveraged, it's invested in property, it's not going well, that is, of course, going to put a crimp on spending. And I think in the medium to longer term, you will see an impact of the rising interest rates in the West that will just simply have the normal macroeconomic impact that it always has, slowing demand, and it's going to slow down. The problem with China is that their population satisfaction depends highly on growth, right? So they're in a bit of a trouble.
So what does that mean, though, for us? What does it mean for you in Jackson, Wyoming? I mean, I saw
Not a darn thing. He's just
A headline that said, no one is immune, J.P. Morgan says. And I thought, wow, they're really playing this a little bit dramatic. And then this morning, you know, everybody was – it's all in the Asia focus, and of course it was our top headline, but we're only off, you know, 13 points on the S&P 500. Is it really that important to markets in the U.S.?
Hard to say. I mean, it's sort of, you mentioned Dartmouth, right, and MBAs. It was really interesting. This whole thing reminds me a little bit of Japan in the late, you know, 80s and the 90s. And even the 90s, I remember going to class and listening to professors, you know, telling us how the Japanese system of more government direction might be superior. And then the next class, you would learn about the free market microeconomics the normal way. And if you pointed out the dichotomy, they'll just be like, well, maybe that's a different class, right? So I think what's going on is economic reality. The Western system, free capitalism is right. China is not playing the game correctly. They have tremendous problems with demography. I think they are going to be a long-term declining power, right? And we're going to have to deal with that, right? I think it'd be very, very dangerous. Declining powers are unstable. They do crazy things.
As we've seen in Ukraine.
Yeah, you see it in Ukraine. You could see it in Taiwan, which would be much more of a problem. China, obviously, much bigger, much more interdependent. And I don't know if we can, as business people, count on, you know, government solve this problem. So I think what I see and what I would do, and this is my background, supply chain management, is advising corporations that what they have done the last 20, 30 years getting it to China has to be done in some way going backwards, because really bad stuff could happen, right? And when really bad stuff happens, it's a game of musical chairs, and there's not enough industrial capacity on the planet to replace China for everybody at the same time quickly.
Hans, when you look at the biggest U.S. manufacturers, is it scary? Are too many of them too deep in?
I think so. I think overall it is. It's too much, right? I mean, you can't replace China with something else in the short term. It's not possible, right? So, but that's also it's also a good news story in some ways, because if there's, you know, a great degree of mutual dependency, creates political stability, right? So for example, I envision that when Biden talks to Xi, they're going to talk about removing tariffs, right? I mean, Biden needs it for U.S. inflation and China needs it for growth, and they're going to figure out this Taiwan thing.
That's kind of where I wanted to go, Hans. I mean, President Xi and President Biden are set to meet later this year. That seems like a big deal to me, at least. What would you like to see on the agenda, on the table for discussion, that maybe we could actually get something done?
Yeah, I think, like I said, I think it's in their mutual interest to get better trade relations going. And I think they're going to do something on the tariff front. I'm pretty sure about that. I mean, it's in everybody's best interest, right? It will certainly have a short-term positive impact on U.S. inflation, which is critical.
And I also wonder what kind of impact we'll have on China. You know, we spoke with a Chinese economist this morning who seemed very worried that, you know, Europeans and Americans would stop buying their goods or not buy their goods as much, and that's a big problem for them.
I can't imagine that. People will always go for price, and most people don't even know what's made in China. So I find that a little bit hard to believe.
Well, no, the idea was that if we go into a recession, we just won't have the purchasing power to keep up the kind of consumerism that we've been practicing.
No, I think that, like I said, I think that's going to happen. I think that's part of the reason why China might be slowing down. But I don't think that we're going to fall off a cliff here in the West or in the U.S.
All right, Hans, great stuff. Really appreciate getting your perspective there. Hans Dahl, CEO of the Mitchell Madison Group.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
Kind of red and green on the screen here. The market, not sure what it wants to do here. We've obviously had that big move off the bottom after that brutal first half of the year for both stocks and bonds. A lot of folks are scratching their heads saying, okay, now what? Let's check in with Jay Hatfield, CEO, founder, and portfolio manager of the Infrastructure Capital Advisors. Jay, now what?
Good morning. Thanks for having me back on. Well, it's a little bit complicated. We had been constructive on stocks heading into earnings, and we were correct that earnings are relatively strong compared to expectations. And we do think the economy is relatively strong because of pandemic tailwinds. But the negatives are an erratic Fed. We think the 2% target is arbitrary and way too low, so they're going to pursue that 2% target. They tend to focus on backward-looking indicators like employment and CPI, whereas they should be looking at the money supply, which is down 15% already this year. And then finally, the other negative is we're headed into September, which is typically a terrible month for stocks. Lack of information about earnings, and then you have a closing of the buyback window. So we're relatively neutral to cautious on stocks here after this big run.
But you think, so Jay, just to go back to the beginning, you don't have a negative outlook on the economy. You think the U.S. economy, even after two quarters of contraction, is still in a pretty strong place.
Yeah, the key facts there, if you look back at the 11 post-World War II recessions, they all had a crash in housing and autos. But we have a pandemic recovery tailwinds in that we're at record low housing inventories, 1.2 million units versus normal 87,000 new cars versus a million. So the chances of mass layoffs in those cyclical sectors are zero. And then you have strong employment because we're moving from goods, which are mostly made overseas, to services, which are all provided in the U.S. and labor intensive. So strong job market and the normal sectors that crack all-time lows for inventories.
We
so
do
we're
see
constructive about the economy.
We do see what looks like some real weakness in the tech sector, and I don't know if that's because they, you know, overhired last year, the beginning of this year, but they're, you know, some of the biggest companies are cutting by 10%. Some of the growthier, frothier companies cutting by 20%. A lot of them are doing hiring freezes. Is this just a sector specific issue?
We think so. What is obviously entirely unique about this cycle is the pandemic. So during the pandemic, those were the big beneficiaries. But of course, services was getting smashed. So you're just seeing a rotation from those goods-producing companies, and also they have exposure to foreign currency. You know, keep in mind, almost no one focuses on the fact that the Fed has already reduced the monetary base or money supply by 15% this year, which is the biggest decline since the Great Depression. That's caused the dollar to skyrocket. So that's going to make those large-cap exporters' earnings weaker. But if you look, they're not really doing mass layoffs. They're just hiring at a slower pace. So that's not enough to derail the U.S. economy.
Jay, you've had a long and varied career on Wall Street, buy side, sell side. One of the industries that you've really focused on has been energy, global power, Morgan Stanley, and so on. Mm-hmm. You know, what we're really starting to understand here is we've got oil pulling back yet again. Now we're at 88 and change on WTI crude. It just seems like the supply and the demand are kind of out of whack. You know, as we make this transition to green energy, there's still a big demand for traditional energy, fossil fuels, and our good friends in Europe, boy, they're going to have a tough winter. How do you think about this economy and how it's trying to manage the transition from fossil fuels to green fuels? Seems like there's going to be some problems there.
Well, I think we've made a massive mistake by not recognizing that natural gas is a very clean fuel. It's the only efficient way to transport hydrogen, because pure hydrogen, you have to cool to negative 451 degrees Fahrenheit to transport it, whereas natural gas is only 250. So the Europeans blew the energy transition by not procuring enough natural gas, which then allows you to shut down coal. In the U.S., the free market did that. That's why we're the leader in the world for reducing carbon, not because of any policy coming from the government, but just because of the economics of having excess natural gas. So, but to your point, we're relatively constructive on the oil market. We're still projecting 90 to 110. But the key factor to watch is European natural gas prices. Yep. They're trading at the equivalent of $400 a barrel of oil on a BTU basis. So that's a huge support for the market. And these China blips are usually temporary. Yep. They're pretty sticky demand in China.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting to see how this plays out. And again, we'll be focusing on Europe this winter. It seems like it's going to be a big challenge for them. Jay Hatfield, CEO, founder, and portfolio manager at Infrastructure Capital Advisors, giving us his thoughts on these markets. Matt, our next guest You and I, we struggle with English, which is a challenge because we speak for a living. But our next guest speaks English and Hebrew. Okay, I get that. Then Russian and Ukrainian. I'm like, who really cares about that? But now that is absolutely front and center. Dr. Ariel Cohen, Senior Fellow for the Atlantic Council, the Eurasia Center. Dr. Cohen, thanks so much for joining us here. You know, I guess we'd love to get an update on what you think the current status is in Ukraine. But what I'd really love to get is, why did Putin do this? It just seems like a monstrous miscalculation here. But I'd love to get your perspective.
The dean of my alma mater, the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, former dean, Admiral Stavridis, former Supreme Allied
Friend of
Commander,
our show.
Yeah, former Supreme Allied Commander NATO, said that Putin realizes that he made a mistake. I met Putin 10 times. So this is kind of a guy who will never admit that he made a mistake. Whether he realizes he made a mistake or not, there's some indications he may be realizing it, but he is desperate to save face. He's not going to give Ukrainians any quarter. So one would hope that we can extricate ourselves out of this horrible war in a few months. But for that, Ukrainians need to deliver the Russians more blows, especially in the south, where they are using the Western supplied long-range rockets to disrupt the Russian logistics. And they're destroying methodically the key bridges. So if the Russian troops are, for example, on the left bank of, on the right bank of the Dnieper, they would pull out possibly because they don't want to stuck there without the bridges. So the logistics is extremely important in this war. And there's another dimension that I'm very worried about, and that's the nuclear power stations. Remember, Ukraine is producing 50% of its electricity through nuclear, contributing less to global emissions than many other countries. But the Russians and the Ukrainians are bombarding some of these stations, including the huge power station in Zaporizhia, four reactors, four units. And the last thing we need is one of these reactors to be punctured by a shell and have a radioactive emissions there, so, God forbid, so, you know, something like Chernobyl. We don't want that.
So, Dr. Cohen, initially I would think for the whole conflict, there should be some back channel way to communicate with Vladimir Putin, figure out a solution. Even if you can't get him to pull completely out of Ukraine, maybe you can say, hey, let's all avoid these nuclear power plants. But then I wonder, how well does the chain of command actually work? How strong is the link? How efficient is communication? Or are these units on the ground really just operating on their own in a sense?
I don't think they're operating on their own. The Russian military is extremely centralized. Who is less centralized, actually, are the Ukrainians. But what we've seen is that the Russians cut a deal with the Turks and with Ukraine, and they are going to allow the grain to flow out of Ukraine, out of the port of Odessa on the Black Sea, to the world markets. Very important, so we don't contribute to, or the conflict doesn't contribute to, people starving in Africa or something like that. And the next day, the Russian military is delivering a rocket strike on the port of Odessa. So questions were raised about that, and then it stopped. So hopefully the command and control chain in Russia is still intact. However, you raised a very important question, and that is, who is communicating with the Russians? And we saw recently that Russia said that Switzerland is not going to be the go-between because Switzerland imposed sanctions on Russia, and therefore the Russians said they're not impartial. So having a channel of communication is important. Having people who could go back and forth, like the late great German foreign minister Genscher, Right. I think it's Frank.
Yeah.
Hans Dieter Genscher.
So, Dr. Cohen, what?
Go ahead.
So, I guess the question is, how strong is the support within Russia for Putin and this war? I think about just our country here. When the dead bodies start coming back, that's when people start taking notice here. How strong is his support?
Remember, Russia, the country that lost 27 million in World War II, civilians and military, they do recognize that wars come with a body count. However, having said that, a lot of Russian families have only one child. It's only one son. And I do believe that there's more discontent, especially among the relatives of the men who died. But Putin's regime is not unlike the Soviet predecessors who kept a tight lid on the public opinion. But we see for now, I stress, the public support is anywhere between 60 and 80%. That's quite considerable. But in the future, the economic situation is going to deteriorate, and it is deteriorating. We can see it right now with Western technology, management, investment, all drying up abruptly, and the Chinese are not capable or don't want to replace the Western economic partners. Russia will continue to deteriorate, and with that, the public support of this war will go down.
Just want to quickly ask about the gas. How difficult is it going to be this winter for the Europeans to access Russian supplies?
You know, it's not going to be pleasant. However, the projections are that by December, 95% of German storage will be filled with gas, and Germany is a key country here.
Yep.
Other countries will need to scramble. The Italians are getting more gas from Algeria on the existing pipeline. They're putting more pumping stations on that pipeline. And countries like Qatar and Australia and others who have any extra LNG, and we in the United States can sell more LNG. There are more regasification ships that are heading towards Europe. It will be more expensive, but I do not believe it'll be a catastrophe.
All right. Dr. Ariel Cohen, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate getting your informed insights. Dr. Ariel Cohen, he's a senior fellow, the Atlantic Council Eurasia Center, deep background and experience in European politics, geopolitics.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You know, last week we had NVIDIA They disappointed with a big miss in revenue. They called out a slump in their gaming business. And I think that caused a lot of folks in the industry to kind of step back and say, all right, let's get a sense of where the gaming industry, which has been such a great growth story within the communication space, where that is right now, where it's going as we come out of the back end of this pandemic. So our next guest is really a timely one. Ann Hand, CEO and chairwoman of Super League Gaming. That is a publicly traded company on the NASDAQ. SLGG is a ticker you can put into your Bloomberg professional service and get all the information you need on that. Ann, thanks so much for joining us here. Give us just kind of tell us what you guys are doing at Super League Gaming, what your company is all about, and kind of how you fit into this gaming ecosystem.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Super League started about 8 years ago, and our focus was really on the fact that these days, if you speak to young kids, pretty much everyone's a gamer. Over 80% of kids say that gaming is their favorite form of entertainment. And this was all pre-COVID, right? So it was already bigger than the film box office, bigger than TV. And we were really focused on kind of debunking the myth of who these gamers are, because gaming these days isn't something that they're going to grow out of. It's very different than the gaming that we did as kids. It's not just you against the machine. It's actually got a fair amount of community and commerce. It's really a place where kids are expressing their physical selves in this digital world. And so they see it as one blended life. And how we fit in is we really focus on what we call metaverse games or open world gaming platforms, because that really speaks to kind of Generation Z and Gen Alpha these days. They're not just there for the competition. They want to step into these games like Minecraft and Roblox. You know, Minecraft's been around for over a decade. And hundreds of millions of kids are spending a lot of their playtime in these worlds where they can create, they can become game designers and developers. But it's also the digital cul-de-sac. It's where their friends are and where they want to interact with their digital selves as much as they want to interact with their physical life. So they kind of call it a digital world that we're living in. And so what I often say to brands and to investors is, we're not talking about, metaverse capital M and something that's kind of abstract and 5 to 10 years away. These games have been around for some time, and this is where kids are. And what we do is we bring brands and advertisers into those worlds to create exciting experiences and content for them.
So how come investors don't seem to get the story or believe in it judged by the stock performance?
I mean, No.
You had a huge jump during the pandemic, but let's leave that out. We've still seen the stock come down to a dollar from, leaving out the $10 peak, six at least.
Yeah, absolutely. I think some of this is just that fundamentally when we're kind of sitting in that nano cap space, the stock doesn't have a lot of stability. That kind of anomaly spike that we had that you pointed out, we became a bit of a meme stock during that time and got swept up in what was happening with AMC and GameStop.
By the way, do you actively work to shun that? Because if I Google SLGG, I'm looking at, all these meme stock kind of results and not so much about the actual company and what you do.
Yeah, no. So that was definitely one of those kind of times where we had that kind of unusual spike. But for us, really, I do agree with you that I think that right now, the market doesn't really, we're not getting the credit probably that I believe we would deserve for the kinds of step change revenue growth that we are showing. And so I have to believe that as we get the more attention to the stock and show those, keep delivering those types of results, that, over time the share price will reflect that. We went from, we went public when we were pre-revenue. And so in 2020, we did about $2 million in revenue. Last year, about $11 million. This year, we gave guidance that we would do $20 to $22 million. We're beating analyst estimates and on plan to deliver those results. And so we feel like that step change top-line growth that we continue to deliver against over time will be reflected in the share price and the ultimate market cap of the company.
And what's your maybe like 3 to 5 year outlook for the esports business in general? Again, it's a business that, you know, a lot of investors aren't really familiar with, but it certainly has the growth characteristics that I'm sure they would like appreciate.
Yeah, you know, the esports category was really where we started as a company. We were really focused on creating a bit of a little league for youth. So think of esports as just competitive video gaming. You know, a lot of projections were saying, hey, that's going to be about a $3 billion business by 2024. That's not that big. We all know that, right? I mean, I ran a $3 billion P&L at BP globally, and it was small-ish. So that esports category, most of that value is really talking about those, the establishment of those professional teams and leagues. You saw the recent IPO of FaZe Clan. And so that is an exciting but a very small subset. What we started to do as a company really around the pandemic, and I think our response is something else that I think that over time investors will give us credit for, is we really cast a much wider net. We said, look, we already have an interesting foothold with young gamers, but let's speak to all the segments of gamers, not just the highly competitive ones. So we now reach, with that strategy that we put into place during COVID, about 70 million unique under 18 gamers a month, namely in games like Minecraft and Roblox. That's sizable reach, really second only to the people who make those platforms themselves, Microsoft and Roblox. And so we have sizable reach in Heft, and we speak to a very diverse audience of gamers. So now we're talking about there's 3 billion gamers on the planet, and in-game advertising is projected to be a $56 billion category by 2024. We think that's far more interesting than just the more narrow segment of just esports.
And you expect to make a profit in your time at the company?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, what we've talked to we just had our earnings call. In fact, we took investors into the metaverse. We did a video earnings announcement, and what we talked about is the fact that not only are we delivering faster on the top line, but we're also seeing our operating losses shrinking faster than expected this year. And so we're very mindful in the current state of the market that while investors last year were pushing us hard on top line,
now
they want it both. They want top line delivery, and they want us to get cash flow positive faster.
All right, Ann, thank you so much for joining us. Ann Hand, CEO and chairwoman of Super League Gaming.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Markets Podcast. You can subscribe and listen to interviews at Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast platform you prefer. I'm Matt Miller. I'm on Twitter at MattMiller1973.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. I'm on Twitter at PT Sweeney. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide at Bloomberg Radio.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take and Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.